Phil, are you having any trouble getting on the network?
I don't know.
It seems like it's down.
Well, my computer seems to be down. Oh, there we are. Let's see.
In a pinch, go with the old standby. Restart.
Well, mine was... The House Committee on Revenue will come to order. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3622, and we have several members who want to testify. Go ahead and give us the summary, and then they can come forward.
Sure. Chair Barnhart, member of the committee. House Bill 3622 changes the method of calculating transportation grants for purposes of the state school fund distribution and directs the school board of a school district determine the distance for which the district will provide transportation services.
Great. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair Barnhart. And I know Representative Berger is somewhere taking care of life, like she always is. For the record, my name is Betty Comp, and I serve House District 22, which is the cities of Woodburn, Jervis, as well as Northeast Salem. I'm going to, if you don't mind, stick to my script a little bit because I want to make sure I don't miss any important parts, but I might hop around a little bit. But today before you is House Bill 3622, which would adjust the way school districts are reimbursed for costs associated with transportation. When our school transportation formula was created, it had an emphasis on ensuring equity between school districts, particularly rural and urban. Colleagues, this was wise then, and it's wise now. For the past 4 years, just a couple of days now, I've been working on legislation to look at that system. Recently, we've met with stakeholders, advocates, and ideas that can work for our schools and our students. Participants have been the Oregon Education Association, Eco Northwest, Oregon School Boards, COSA, Chalkboard, Oregon School Employees, and several school districts around the state. Many ideas. We spent many hours. Many ideas were discussed, and all were innovative and prudent. We are considering incentivizing the utilization of walking and public transportation to cut costs. We discussed block grants as well as a variation of the current formula. Brian Reeder was going to be here today. He is one of the main proponents. Well, the department is neutral on the bill, but this is work that Brian Reeder's been working on probably for at least 10, 12 years. The finished product is a structure that you have before you today. This block grant will initially be based on the average of transportation grants from the past 3 school years, will be revised yearly on ridership and other inflationary costs by determining the School Revenue Forecast Committee, which is an appointed committee at the department. Encourage cost savings by allowing school districts to keep any leftover money from the grant. Currently, if school districts are fiscally conservative, in fact, Salem-Keizer is a perfect example, they feel like they're being penalized by us implementing this at this time. They saved over $100,000 in their transportation funding last year, but all that money went back to the state school fund. Under this grant, they would have gotten to keep that money and spent it in classrooms or in other ways that they see fit. House Bill 3622 will empower local districts to be innovative and give control of school transportation back to local school boards. One thing that was very important for the advocates was to maintain equity in our current system. We preserved that. We've heard a lot of we've heard a lot of comments. Does our system need fixing? The unequivocally answer is yes. Right now, money is just automatically given to school districts without any incentives being addressed. These incentives with cost savings will stay with the district. Recently, the Forest Grove News Times recently reported that the Forest Grove School District is considering closing Gales Creek Elementary School and shifting those students to Dilley Elementary, even though transporting them would end up costing them more than the savings. When faced with this, the district indicated those costs aren't a big concern because the state pays 75%, so it didn't matter how much it cost. It just, for the transportation, they just were going to do this anyway. This is wrong. I acknowledge that transporting our students is fundamental. If they don't get to the classroom, they don't learn. However, in this tough budget environment, we need to find as many efficiencies and savings as we can. My colleagues on my right and my left are here to talk about additional thoughts that they have on this bill. Co-Chair Berger also is interested in looking at the Connie, Betsy part of how we look at things. And also today to testify is John Taponia from Eco Northwest, who did a major study on this issue a couple of years ago. And I'm open for questions, and I really appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you. Gentlemen.
Mr. Chair, Cliff Bentz, State Representative of District 60, appearing in support of this bill. Representative Reed and I have been working on a concept that we'll be sharing with this committee, I think, next week. And it happens that the concept in general was to figure out a way of making alternative fuels available across the state of Oregon so that our economy could benefit from some of the lower cost and lower price fuels that are available but aren't being used. One of the methods of trying to encourage the use of other fuels would be to convert our state fleet of school buses to natural gas or, as we've heard, propane or some other fuel of like nature, but an alternative to the diesel fuels that are now being used. It happened when I heard of Representative Combs' bill that this seemed to be a natural opportunity for the savings that a district could achieve to be used for the conversion of these fleets. The materials we'll hand out next week will show that on today's prices, those savings would be somewhere between $2.50 and $3 a gallon, which was an astounding savings and one that would hopefully pay for conversion of these fleets and then make available those savings also. So it would be an opportunity to springboard from these this freezing of the transportation grant into a longer-term savings for our school districts, and it's not to mention all the other benefits that we'll share with the committee next week.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jules Bailey. I have the honor of representing House District 42. I guess, Representative Comp, when you said your colleagues to your right and left, you were speaking from their perspective looking this way as opposed to your perspective looking that way. We're aligned properly for that spectrum. But I wanted to just add a little bit more about why I get excited about this bill and my gratitude for Representative Comp and all the people that have worked hard to bring it forward. I understand it's been a long process to get to a point on this bill. As Representative Bentz mentioned, there is an enormous opportunity in cost savings at school districts from improvements and retrofits within school bus fleets and school transportation, and the potential for cost savings out of things like conversion to compressed natural gas or alternative fuels that cost the school district less and are better for air quality and better for the environment and better for the health of children, also have the added benefit of having the potential to keep children safer. Why? Because in other vehicles in this, no pun intended, in this legislative body, we have financing mechanisms, such as potentially through the Cool Schools proposal, to provide those tools to school districts to be able to upgrade their fleets. and then potentially bring some of that savings into things like seismic and earthquake safety retrofits and other improvements to schools that will keep children safer and create better learning and teaching environments. That really is part of the overall win here. But the key to this is the ability to utilize that cost-effective savings that comes from improvements in school bus transportation and the ability to unlock that savings and use it for a wide range of different opportunities from safety to better instruction is really what gets me excited about this bill, and I look forward to having this as an integral part of that conversation.
Co-chair, can I make one additional
Please.
Comment?
Yeah.
It's been my it has absolutely been my honor to have a career late in life that has involved students and being around students. And one of my most, believe it or not, some people think I'm a little crazy, but you already know that. But to make sure that I was always there in the morning when the students got off the bus, and I was always there in the afternoon making sure they got safely on the bus. And what I can say as somebody that stood around the running buses and all the fumes and all the diesel, we have a very good statistical report about what is this doing to our children's health. And being on the perimeter of the bus is nothing compared to what it is being on the bus every day, some students up to an hour, and breathing those kinds of emissions that we know that just aren't good for our children. And so when Representative Bailey talks about the health, this is not a minor issue. It is a big issue. And if we can help our children breathe easier, and I can't even imagine what it would be like if you had asthma and rode some of these buses. But there's so many positives that I won't take more time to share some of those. But there's much more to this bigger picture.
Thank you. Questions?
Yes.
I have a couple, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And I walked in a couple of minutes late and certainly agree with the importance of having more efficient school buses and keeping our kids away from fumes. Are we on House Bill 3622?
Yes.
Yes.
I cannot find where that is in the bill. What in the bill addresses retrofits of school buses in House Bill 3622?
At this point, go ahead, Joanne. At this point, this was the original bill, and what we hope to do is to make additions to have those pieces complement this bill.
Okay, thank you. And a follow-up?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think as Representative Bailey mentioned, this bill has taken a long road, and I know this is something that you've been working on for a long time, Representative Comp. And I think you know part of the debate about this bill has been some of us trying to understand how school districts would save money on doing this, since they don't receive the reimbursement for transportation until after they've spent those dollars. And I'm wondering, I've got a little story to tell and then a question. I'm wondering what sideboards are here to ensure that the savings comes from things like increased efficiency and safer buses as opposed to contracting out school bus services. I know in the district that I used to serve on the school board for, prior to going onto the school board, the district contracted out its school busing services, which I think was a terrible mistake. It's a mistake you can't come back from because you sell your fleet of buses, which then also makes it difficult to go back and mandate the improvement in the efficiency. What we found since then were longer bus routes for students. They spent a longer time on school. We had no control over the quality of the personnel that were driving those buses. We have a difficult time with the company that we contract with having people there. There's actually signs in the fields around our community saying we need school bus drivers, no experience necessary. I wouldn't want to put my kid on a bus with no experience necessary. We have kids that get late to school. Our special ed buses, kids miss whole periods of school because of the way that they stack them. We have all kinds of safety violations because they're not trained about how to strap kids on and off buses. And I think that some districts, having gone down this road, would go back, but they can't because they can't afford to buy the fleets back. So my question is, how can schools save money when they're already working so hard to save every penny they can? Kids are already on school bus routes way too long. Do we want them on longer? And how does this bill keep us from contracting out our school bus services and putting kids at risk for their safety, their health, and frankly for losing minutes out of their school day, which is the most important thing that we do in school, is teach kids?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Gelzer, you just made the argument why this bill is important. What this bill does is give local control back to the school boards and that they can make these decisions. I am the first to acknowledge that many school districts have made, they have negotiated contracts and agreements over their bus fleets. They did that in good faith, thinking that they were saving money. The reality is there are two major bus fleets, and I did not bring the statistics, but I have them if you would like a copy. In the state, they now have hired pretty high-powered lobbyists to oppose this bill, which I find interesting. But the second part of this is, when you renegotiate your contract, you have options open to you as a district. One of the things that I did not talk about, but that is a possibility, and I use North Marion County as a good regional example. You have North Marion, you have Jervis, you have Woodburn, you have Mount Angel. You have five tiny school districts all within about an eight-mile radius. Well, some of them have still their own fleets, some subcontract out. But with this, because they know that they're going to keep their savings, which they didn't before, they can join together and make one, just have one consolidated transportation service. They may decide to purchase a few buses on their own in their own sequence to get back to their own maintenance. This leaves them an array of opportunities, because this is about ridership and how many miles the student gets. It's not about just how much money the school district spends. So instead of a blank check, just getting 75%, 80%, or 90%, now if school districts break that down, show it to the state, then it's going to be a whole different game, because the local control voice is in there and it's available. And yes, it will take time to, if they go back to buy their own fleets, it will take time. But what many school districts, Salem, Kaiser attested to the fact repeatedly, they were assured with their contract that there was going to be all these cost savings. Well, after that first contract was up in 3 years, then all of a sudden all their prices soared, and they have paid much more for transportation than what they were originally told, and yet they were committed to their contract. And so it's a real interesting enterprise and a business. It is business. It is big business for several of these bus companies, but when local boards go back to have that opportunity to have these discussions, I think we will see a lot of innovation happen.
And one further follow-up, Mr.
Please.
Chair?
Yeah,
I think that most boards, if they go down the road of contracting out their classified employee services, whether those are professional bus driving services, custodial services, food services, they're going to find that they will regret that later. The savings will disappear, and the quality of services to our students will decline rapidly. We have seen that in many districts, and I hope districts that are considering that during this time will look closely. I know OSEA did a great study probably back in 2003, 2004 that looked at the high price of contracting out these services. You had mentioned how this puts kind of empowers local school boards and kind of restores local control. With these improvements to the bill, since it's come here from its original form in the Education Committee, has this now picked up the support of the Oregon School Boards Association and the Oregon School Employees Association that represents the professional bus drivers in Oregon?
At this time, several of those organizations are still neutral. The Oregon Association, OSEA, thank you, is definitely in opposition. and they are concerned about a range of things, and particularly student safety. And there are components in this bill that deal with student safety, but a number, and the department is neutral, and but over the path of what we've the path that we've come with this bill, having people be neutral is a whole lot better than it was 2 years ago.
Thank you. And one final question,
yes,
Mr. Chair. Do you know, just generally, because you're on all of the education policy committees, how many bills has the department taken a position on this session, either in support or opposition?
Co-Chair Barnhart and Co-Chair Gelser for Education, I don't have that answer, but I don't think they've taken a position on very many.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Bailey.
Mr. Co-Chair, if I might respond to a couple of the questions.
Please.
And I'm getting the sense of what fun the Education Committee must be. To speak specifically to the retrofit portion of the bill, you can think of an analogy of, imagine you're a college kid and you're driving an old beater car, but your parents are paying for your gas money. Well, you might want to drive something a little bit better, but there's not a whole lot of incentive if you can't hold on to the savings of getting that more fuel-efficient car. So where this bill intersects with those efforts, this is not a financing bill, but there are other vehicles moving through the legislature that do provide those cost-effective financing solutions to be able to upgrade school buses. This provides that sort of basic underlying economic ability to be able to reap some of those savings and have an incentive to be able to move forward on more efficient, cleaner, and safer school buses.
Co-Chair Barnhart, and John Tapania is here, and he is much more of an expert on this than I would ever profess to be, so I'm sure he'd welcome questions.
And he's on our list to testify. I have one question. I think it's your testimony that the 30% copay that the school district has to come up with isn't sufficient to encourage school districts, sufficiently encouraging to school districts to find efficient ways to provide transportation. Is that your testimony?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. I may respectfully disagree, at least in the case of the Eugene School District, which went to quite an effort during the time I was on the school board to make a number of modifications to save money, because they thought saving part of their portion of the 30% was very much worth doing.
And Co-Chair Barnhart, I totally agree with you. It is district by district, but knowing that 20 school districts get reimbursed 90% of their funds, and then another 20 school districts get 80%, and the rest get 70%. I know Paul Warner can give you a printout and a run of what that cost is per student, per district. And it is not unusual for some districts that pay $5,000, $7,000, or more per student to transport them. And it's no small amount, and Co-Chair Gelser would also testify that we have looked at, when we looked at the closing of the school for the blind, the amazing amounts of money that our state has spent in transporting flying students back and forth to a facility twice a week at unbelievable cost. And they just, it is an assumed cost because they know that they will get basically almost, well, I don't know what the total reimbursement was, but I mean, we're talking $20,000-$30,000 per student. And that is the exception. It's absolutely the exception. But is that, in these economic times, are those exceptions acceptable?
And if I understand correctly, the ones you just referred to are students who are on IEPs that require specialized educational plans.
Which we pay high cost additional plans. But Representative Gelser can provide lots more information.
Right. I think it would be important to clarify there were no students in Oregon that were being flown. They were being driven, but there was no one that was, and I don't think there was any student that approached $30,000 in transportation costs per year. I mean, and the cost for students, well, but I would suggest that we had...
One of the things about issues. A factual disagreement is that it's easy to figure this out, out, and so let's find out. And,
right.
Yeah, okay.
Well, and some of those figures we did see in Ways and Means, and so that would be a difference, so thank
you. Thank you. Anything else? Okay, let's go ahead. Chris Ellison, Tricia Smith. Good morning.
Good morning, Co-Chair Barnhart, members of the Revenue Committee. Thank you for this opportunity to address this important issue. For the record, I am Chris Ellison, President of Oregon People Transportation Association and Director of Transportation, Greater Albany Public Schools. I have submitted written testimony to you today, but I'd like to summarize my submission for your convenience. It's my understanding that the proposed House Bill 3622 is intended to improve efficiencies through a change in the funding model for pupil transportation. The changes, the changes proposed in House Bill 3622 have me very concerned for several reasons. One, repealing the 1 and 1.5 mile walk distances for students and allowing school boards to determine a reasonable distance for students to walk to school. This bill removes the mandatory nature of providing transportation as well as removing the specifics of distance. Allowing individual school boards to determine the distances for transportation may create statewide equity issues for student access to education. For instance, do students now have to walk 5 miles to school in District A, but only a half mile in District B? This bill transfers all risk from the state to local school boards without providing appropriate guidelines for service. Does this bill create safety issues? Yes, it will create safety inequities. It will create safety issues and create inequities. Placing the responsibility on school boards makes this a very subjective process that may expose or create a liability exposure for the board members who make these decisions. You cannot put a price on student safety. Repealing the bus and garage depreciation fund. It's a fact that new buses are safer and more efficient than the older buses that they replace. In fact, since 2007, the emissions of school buses have improved such that the air going out is cleaner than the air going in. This was a federal mandate in 2007 and 2010 emissions. By repealing the depreciation fund, districts have a disincentive to purchase these new buses, which maintains the safety and overall efficiency. This will also create a massive financial issue to districts in their debt obligations and ability in the future to replace buses which meet the stringent emission standards as set forth by the Oregon legislature and recover costs for the garage. This bill also will revise the method of calculating the transportation grant for the state school fund distributions. Representative Comp mentions that 20 school districts are at 90% reimbursement, 20 are at 80% reimbursement, and the rest are at 70. The rest at 70 represent obviously 80% of the districts. Revising the method of calculating the transportation grant may prove to reduce the amount of state support and place a larger obligation on local districts. By moving to a block type grant based on the previous 3-year period, this could provide districts an incentive to eliminate transportation services. The unintended result will be to punish many efficient school transportation systems. The average of the prior 3 years will have a negative impact on many school districts, large and small. The cost of doing business will still exist and now must be funded from the general fund of the school district to provide the same level of service. This in and of itself forces an efficient district to examine their current service levels and reduce them or fund them from monies that would otherwise go to the classroom. The economy has demonstrated great fluctuations, and having a 3-year average may result in some unforeseen expenses. For example, predicting fuel prices, changing emission standards, or an influx of students that are protected by the McKinney-Vento Act, just to name a few.
Now, and you did indicate that you were going to summarize
yes.
rather than read your testimony.
Yep.
And
I am.
That would be appreciated.
I am. So, and finally, this bill does not define service levels. So, in closing, I would like to point out and remind the committee that the yellow school bus is by far the most efficient and safest form of land transportation in the world. The school bus is 7 times safer than the family car. One school bus does a work of 36 cars. Oregon school buses travel over 67 million miles per year. Oregon should be proud that there have been no student fatalities in the last 5 years. Bless you. Again, you cannot put a price on student safety. Representative Barnhart, members of the Revenue Committee, thank you so much for your time in allowing me to speak on this bill.
Thank you. Tricia.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith, and I'm here representing Oregon School Employees Association, 21,000 education professionals working all over the state in Head Start associations, K-12 districts, CSDs, community colleges, and other locations. We are here as Representative Comp informed you in opposition to House Bill 3622. We are actually in opposition to the concepts contained within the bill, as we have consistently been since it was brought to us first by the Chalkboard Project several sessions ago. The reason that we are, first let me tell you just for a moment why the transportation grant exists the way it does. The reason it does is because Oregon compels students to go to school. And the legislature believed that since it was requiring children to come to school, in this day and age, it had to understand and recognize that some parents can't get their kids to school. Some kids live too far away from school. Some kids' parents wouldn't take them to school even if they could. And if we want kids to be in school, we have to make sure they can get there. Not only that, these are other people's children. So that means we have to make sure they get there safely. So the legislature, in its wisdom, determined that school districts would be required to transport students to and from school if they lived more than a mile from elementary schools or a mile and a half from secondary schools. They did this because some districts in budget crises had abandoned transportation. And those parents and those kids were stuck. And then they put a reimbursement formula in the state school fund that recognized that districts cannot control the major cost factors within their transportation program. They don't determine the cost of school buses. They don't decide where kids live. They don't decide how much diesel costs right now. So those things have to be accounted for so that student safety wouldn't be what is compromised in dealing with those costs. So that's why the reimbursement formula exists as it does. The reason it's not a full reimbursement formula is because the legislature wanted districts to have skin in this game, to make sure that they weren't transporting kids a half a mile from school. They could get there on their own. And we, by the way, have never had enough money in schools. So districts look at that 30% lovingly, wantingly, and they put pressure on their transportation programs to the point that our statistics show that transportation costs to the state have increased at 1% or less every year for the last decade. Now, you know transportation costs haven't just increased 1%, but districts are saving money everywhere they can, including in transportation. So we don't believe this bill gets at any real problem. The grant that's proposed would indeed allow districts to cut their transportation costs either by changing the distance that they're willing to transport kids beyond or some other change. Sometimes districts think they're saving money by not buying new buses when, in fact, the legislature understood when it passed Senate Bill 610 in 2009 that replacing buses on a regular basis saves districts money. Buses, like commercial vehicles, have a lifetime of about 10 to 12 years, and then they start costing you more money to run than they do to replace. So there is a mandate that districts have a replacement policy and stick with it. There is also a mandate in the law that they retrofit their buses so that those clean air standards in the that were established for 2007 buses can be met. And that has to happen by 2017. You've already taken care of it. In terms of the natural gas discussion that we heard, that's the first time I've heard the discussion. What I know about natural gas is there are no filling stations out there that districts can use, and no districts have natural gas buses as a result of that. So that's one issue, and I don't know what the legislation is that we're talking about. So the grant money that a district saves under this bill, they get that one time. The next year, when their transportation costs are adjusted, it's going to adjust downward because they've saved money in transportation. So that money won't be there after that first year. So what are they really saving? What they're doing is compromising safety because we're in a fiscal crisis. We'd prefer that you go get the rest of the money out of Ed Stability Fund and not put districts in that position. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to thank Mr. Ellison for coming back. We had an exchange after you were at the legislature before, and I hope you will come back many times and feel very welcome here and welcome to express your concerns and ideas. And I just wanted to thank both of you for raising the idea of student safety. I think if you think about reading the news or watching the news, there are few things that create a more emotional response than seeing an accident that involves a school bus. People become concerned about that bus driver, about the students. For those of us that are parents or grandparents, I know I very carefully think about who I allow my child to get into a car with. I think as policymakers, we owe it to the families in Oregon to make sure that our kids are safe when they are on the road in publicly financed school buses, and we absolutely cannot compromise that safety in any way. If kids can't get to and from school safety, they can't learn. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wanda and then Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So from your testimony, what I'm gathering is that your position is that there's no problem with the current way that we're funding transportation.
That is correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wan, that is correct. We support the current funding mechanism for transportation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment that I think is perhaps only tangentially related to some of the testimony that's been given already. And it comes with a caveat for me that I have not spent the time on this issue that many others have, so I want to recognize that and thank those that have. But it does occur to me to be intrigued and interested in the idea of the distance flexibility to recognize and acknowledge the different circumstances the different districts have. I learned about an interesting concept recently that was attractive because of another aspect of transportation as it relates to physical health of students, and certainly there are safety issues there too, but the idea of a walking school bus. So as we talk about the transportation, I want to make sure that we keep in mind that there are some significant cost savings and physical health benefits as we focus on ways that students can get to school safely under their own power.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Kind of following up on that line.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our school districts today in Oregon have wellness committees, and many of them are focusing on walk and bike to school initiatives where they are creating groups of individuals where they can meet in places and walk and bike in large groups so that they can get there safely, even if there isn't a parent to accompany them. And that's, I know, one of the things that excites kids in our district the most. They make competitions among kids, and our kids, we live several miles from the school, but our kids will say, will you take us in within a half mile of school and drop us off so we can walk or bike the rest of the way? But it's exciting to see how incented kids and families are to do that.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. John Tapania. Good morning.
Good morning. co-chairs, members of the committee. I'm John Tapponia, president of Echo Northwest, an Oregon economic consulting firm that's been in business since 1974. As some who testified before have indicated, Echo Northwest has been working with the Chalkboard Project for a number of years looking at this aspect of school finance. And very, very simply, from an economist's perspective, prices matter, and prices influence behavior. And in essence, what you have set up here is you have a state school fund in its entirety that is largely a block grant. You set an amount of money with weights, some of it for regular education, some of it for special education, some of it for English language learners, and you send it to districts, and they manage it to the best of their ability. On the side, you have a different price and a different program operating that's an open-ended match rate. When you have an open-ended match rate program operating in conjunction or next to a block grant program, to distort behavior at the local level. Representative Kopp, in her introductory points, gave the example of Forest Grove and the Gales Creek Elementary School school closure debate that is going on right now. So, in essence, given the setup that you have now, if Forest Grove closes that elementary school, they get to keep a full dollar of savings for the principal that they eliminate, for the energy consumption that they eliminate, for any leasing that they do of that school. The consequence of having closed that school is transporting the students further. And you can see in that debate in that local community, they've said, well, shoot, Representative Barnhart will pick up 75% of that cost because that's the incentive that we have. So the cost-benefit analysis that the local district is operating under is distorted under that framework. I've seen the same thing happen when the Multnomah County ITAX expired for Portland Public Schools and the other schools around it. At that point, then Superintendent Vicki Phillips drew up a long list of potential actions to balance what she perceived to be a $57 million budget shortfall. And there was an awful lot of very hard decisions to make, 150 teachers, school closures, shortened school years, et cetera. And then eventually you come down to a list, and the transportation group had come up with a number of recommendations on what they could do to help balance the budget. And when they got to that part, they said, okay, we can do these things. These are all politically difficult things to do. These are things that parents are not going to support. And we have to take that amount of money and multiply it by 0.3 or 30%, and that's the amount that the district gets to keep. The rest of it, we're doing all this hard work, making all these difficult political decisions on behalf of the state because they're the one with the skin in the game in this particular case. So very simply, when you're operating the vast majority of the state school fund as a block grant and you have a program next to it that is an open-ended match rate, you are distorting decisions at the local level. My understanding of the intent of this bill is that a well-run, efficient transportation program should be able to get the same amount of money and run exactly the same program under this bill and under that block grant. And to Representative Gelser's point earlier, the sideboards on that are a very vigorous, interested parental community who are quite vocal and are very concerned about the safety of their kids and the ability to get their kids to school on time and safely. So with that, I'll pause and open up for questions.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. We very much appreciate it this morning. Thank you for coming down.
Thank you.
I see that some representatives of the Oregon School Boards Association is here. Do you want to be heard today?
Good Thank you, Co-Chair Barnhart. For the record, Morgan Allen with the Oregon School Boards Association. I guess I'm up here to provide a clarification that the School Boards Association does not support the bill as currently written. I think we have two primary concerns with the bill. The first, I think you heard from a couple of the testifiers, and that is essentially if you pick a floor, whether it's a single-year starting point or an average of several years as sort of the funding base or the floor, that locks in transportation funding to school districts that are efficient, and they, if they're already operating at the margin, they're pinching every penny, and they are running an efficient system, there is no money available for them to transfer to other parts of the educational system. So we have some concerns with that, you know, the starting point. The other thing that we have a concern with is turning over the bill talks about having the school revenue forecast committee, the department, I believe even the state board, somehow involved in deciding how much to increase or when and how much to adjust transportation costs for our school districts. That is of concern to us because it's very undefined, and especially with the volatility of fuel costs and things that our districts can't control, like new housing divisions being built in their districts, for example, or students moving into the district, that concerns us. I will say it's interesting, and I was talking to some of my colleagues that have been in the process much longer than I have about the mandate, the 1 mile and 1.5 mile mandate. I think that is a place where our organization would be willing to go and talk with the legislature about perhaps allowing our school boards more flexibility in cases where, there's really easy transportation for students, and, you know, it's one kid lives on one side of the road and they're just a shade over that mile, and all the kids in their neighborhood that live on the other side of the road walk to school, you know, some things like that, given our some school boards flexibility for that. But just to clarify for the record, we do have a couple concerns with the bill as currently constructed, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Wand.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So do you agree that there is a problem with the transportation funding mechanism that we currently have?
Co-Chair Barnhart, Representative Wand, in my previous job at the Department of Education, I was one of the staff people, along with Brian Reeder. The legislature, I believe it was the 07 session, gave the department, I think it was $250,000, and you know, put out to bid, let's study transportation. Echo Northwest won that contract and studied it. I've looked at that, and you know, the conclusion that Mr. Tapania and the other folks from Echo involved in that report have said that you could, and I can't remember the exact number, so you know, Mr. Tapania could correct me, but if every school district operated at maximum efficiency, you could squeeze out maybe $10 or $15 million per year from the transportation system. The problem is I think the hard thing for me as a layperson, I'm not an economist, is it's very hard to understand, I think, the mathematical formula behind that. I've never seen sort of a plain English explanation of that. I understand the concept is that if school districts are not required to cover the whole cost of their transporting students, then somehow there are districts that are going to be scofflaws and not care how much it's going to cost, and they're, you know, we hear some anecdotal stories about that. But our organization's opinion overall, you know, I think, you know, most school districts are operating their bus services as efficiently as they can at right now. So I mean, I think that is your question is open to debate, and I think there are good arguments on both sides of that.
So, well, I'm very interested in the debate and the economics as well, but I'm just wondering, from your organization's perspective, have you drawn a conclusion? Do we have a problem with transportation funding in education or not?
I think Co-Chair Barnhart, Representative Wand, if you mean, I guess I would need a little definition of the problem. If are districts being wasteful, or, you know, is the funding level appropriate, or is it the mandate safe? I think I'd start with the funding. I think, you know, there is plenty of incentive for school districts to pinch pennies and try to find efficiencies. They're not covered for all their costs. If there's ways the legislature wants to look at, I think maybe the problem is that you know, our school boards and school districts have no flexibility. There's a statewide mandate, and I understand that's for safety purposes, but there's no flexibility within the system for our districts to sort of do things differently at the local level at this point.
Mr. Kosher, just try a third time.
Yeah.
I really want to know from your organization's perspective. I heard from two other organizations, and they said that they feel the current system is fine, and they don't see any problems with it.
Right.
So I just want to know from your organization's perspective, is the current system fine, or are there problems with it?
Co-Chair Barnhart, Representative Wand, I think what the answer to that question is that we support the current system until we see a system that we think is better for our districts, and I don't think the bill contains that at this point.
Great. Thank you. Last follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So I'll be looking forward to your solution. If you guys have ideas and things that we can look at to help stretch our transportation dollar further, I'd be really happy to see you guys come forward with that. And I'm sorry to press you publicly here. I know you're a fine man and represent a great organization, but one of the things that we have to try to do here is identify problems and then look for solutions that work the best for everybody. So I'm glad to hear that you guys see some problems. Look forward to working with you to help fix them. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Geltzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is along the lines of identifying problems. Oregon School Boards Association holds listening sessions, and you meet with your locally elected board members across the state relatively regularly to solicit their concerns about the challenges that they're facing. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
When you go to these sessions, is our transportation funding formula at the top of the list? Is that something that is frequently raised by your locally elected school board members that are deeply enmeshed in this every day as a top priority to fix?
Co-Chair Barnhart, Representative Geltzer, I personally have not been privy to any of those conversations, but I will be happy to check with our staff and get you an answer to that question.
Thank you. And one further follow-up?
Please, yes.
Thank you. And when you're following up with that, I would be curious to learn if there are concerns from those locally elected school board members who are entrenched in education policy every day, if their concerns are around the formula, around the amount of time that students are already spending on buses each day, or around safety, what those discussions around transportation are focused on.
Absolutely. Thank you. Others? Is there anyone else who'd like to be heard this morning on this bill? Thank you. Just one final comment before you go, and you may want to respond to this one. This issue is not new. It's one that we've been dealing with for a long, long time. We've tried different methods of getting at it, as was pointed out in some of the earlier testimony, because of the way funding was done earlier. Some districts actually abandoned transportation for students to the significant detriment of the kids. And I don't think anybody believes that there is a perfect solution, or at least that we found it yet. Would you agree with that?
Co-Chair Barnhart, I think what I would say is, you know, and I know that's what Representative Wan was trying to get at. I would encourage the committee to look at the report that Echo Northwest did, because they did, in my opinion, a good job of looking at whether other states do. I think they looked at probably somewhere between 4 and 6 models that other states use, and they laid out the pros and cons of each of those models, and their conclusion was that the block grant model provided the best incentive from a sort of an economics point of view. So I would sort of reassert my statement and agree with you that, you know, if there's a better system out there, we're ready to look at that, but we're not convinced at this point that this is the perfect solution for school transportation funding in Oregon.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I think that the legislature is going to keep worrying this issue until everyone is completely satisfied, and I suspect that may take a while. Thank you. Thank you very much. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3622 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3606. Chris.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3606 deals with a somewhat obscure credit known as the Business Energy Tax Credit. Makes a few clarifications or changes.
I've heard of it.
We've heard of it, yes.
It provides that the first year a transferee may claim the tax credit is the year that the transferee files a completed application for final certification. The bill also provides that the total rather than the certified cost of a project is reduced by an applicable federal grant amount. It clarifies that the applicants are eligible, that the applicants are eligible to participate in the tax program and a low-interest government-sponsored loan program. It also clarifies that for renewable projects, with a certified cost of at least $10 million. An application for final certification shall be considered complete without the identification of a transferee and applies to applications for final certification filed on or after January 1, 2010.
Wonderful. Representative Bailey, welcome again.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jules Bailey. I have the honor of representing House District 42. And as you got a sense from the last bill, the only bills I ever get involved with are things that are uncomplicated and not controversial. So in that spirit, I bring you House Bill
4606. And we appreciate that very much.
Mr. Chair, did he say both of those things, uncontroversial and non-complicated?
House Bill 3606, though, really is just a technical fix to the Betsy program that ensures greater certainty looking backwards instead of looking forward. And I really want to create that distinction. I wish that Representative Brewer was able to be here with us today to bring her her fine technical knowledge around accounting to this bill, but it's been a pleasure to work with her and Senator Telfer on this bill, as well as the stakeholders who have been involved with this process and the department. And it is a distinct effort from the look forward on whatever might become of programs that have been known as the Business Energy Tax Credit. That effort has been an ongoing and difficult effort that many of you have been leading and involved with. What this is a technical fix to the bill that this body passed in the 2010 session. That did such things as creating what is now known as a six-year Betsy instead of the five-year Betsy. It also clarifies provisions around when pass-through partners can be found and identified, around how federal grants interact with the Betsy. The bill that this body passed did not appropriately address clarity on how those federal grants are treated, and also on credit start year. I want to express my thanks to the department. My understanding is that the Department is of Energy is moving to make many of these changes in rule, but that actually illustrates the importance of having a piece of legislation, because certainty is so important to these businesses as they make their investment decisions. We want to make sure that these changes are codified in statute so that there is certainty to the market and how these applicants and partners are going through. Again, this does not change the cap on the Business Energy Tax Credit Program. It does not change the sunset on the Business Energy Program, Tax Credit Program. All it does is look back on clarifying the rules around pass-through partners, applications, grant interaction, and technical issues. And with that, I'd be happy to welcome up the smart minds who have been dealing with this.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. I'm going to just take people in order this morning. David Brown, Rob O'Neill, and Kevin Lynch. And, of course, you can testify in a different order if you'd prefer.
You're in the middle. Chair Barnhart, we're all friends, so thank you very much for scheduling this bill. And Co-Chair Bailey, thank you very much for your very, very good summary. I did give the committee short, just under a page and a half, summary of these three technical fixes. I think it'd probably be good if I just explain that our larger solar projects in Central Oregon are frozen, waiting to have these fixes clarified, and then we can proceed. And I'd be very happy to answer any questions that the committee might have on them, rather than kind of forcing you through the keyhole of these technical changes.
Okay, why don't we hear from the others, and then there may very well be some questions.
Thank you, Co-Chair Barnhart and other members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rob O'Neill. I'm the state and local tax partner with Moss Adams LLP, a public accounting firm and tax consulting firm with offices in Portland, Eugene, and Medford. Moss Adams is the largest accounting firm in the state of Oregon. and we represent a number of renewable energy project owners and buyers of the BETC credit. I'm here today in support of House Bill 3606. Moss Adams has been heavily involved in the BETC program since it was first expanded in 2007 to include renewable energy projects. Moss Adams provides a wide range of consulting services to the project's owners developing both renewable energy and conservation projects. We have assisted clients through the entire BETC process, from determining whether projects qualify for BETC, assistance with the preliminary and final applications, required agreed-upon procedures, and monetization of the credits. We have seen the tremendous amount of success the program has had through the number of jobs and investment brought to the state. However, as a result of the changes made to the BETC program by House Bill 3680 during the 2010 special legislative session, many companies are now hesitant to invest in Oregon, and some have moved their projects to other states. House Bill 3606 plays a vital role in allowing the state to fulfill its commitment to the companies that invested in Oregon, with the reliance on the promises made by the state through the BETC program. The changes made by House Bill 3606 to Oregon statute will allow companies to be made whole through receiving the full BETC incentive promised by the state, and also restores much-needed credibility to the state and its economic development initiatives. Our clients are willing to make investments in the state exceeding $3 billion. Direct jobs created by these investments have and will generate in excess of 500 jobs. The indirect and temporary jobs created by these projects exceed several thousand. If this bill is not passed, I do fear that these certain project owners may seek legal action against the state. I do believe the bill, as written, requires certain technical corrections. In Section 1, Transfer E should read Transfer Or. Section 4, the changes should apply to all applications for final certification, not just applications after January 1st, 2010. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I recommend the Revenue Committee approve the bill with the noted technical changes. Thank you. Any questions?
I will have some because I want you to go back over what you just said, because I don't have it yet. But let's go ahead and.
Sure. Good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Kevin Lynch, and I lead the Policy and Regulation Group for Iberdrola Renewables, which is an Oregon-based company that builds and operates wind, solar, and biomass facilities both in Oregon and around the U.S. Our headquarters are in Portland. We have about 400 employees here in the state of Oregon. I come to speak generally in support of House Bill 3606, but similar to the immediately prior testimony, might have some suggestions for some technical and minor substantive changes to the legislation that's introduced. Very much appreciate your willingness to consider some ways further to clean up some of the distance between the intent of the legislature to revise the BETC program through the 2009 and 2010 amendments and the actual implementation of those changes in practice, which have created some problems. And let me just provide an illustration, particularly with respect to the effective date issue in House Bill 3606. Our company actually has a wind project. Well, two, actually, but one in particular that I'll illustrate for you, in which we apply. This is a timeline that gives you a sense of the problem. We applied for a preliminary certificate for a BETC in September of 2007. We initiated construction on the project in 2008 and completed construction of the project in early 2009. We received a preliminary certification for this project in December of 2009. I'm sorry, December of 2008. We applied for final certification in February of 2009, slightly after, of course, we finished the project, completed the project. So that is now more than 2 years ago. About 6 months later, the Department of Energy gave us a letter indicating how much our certified eligible costs for the BETC were at that time. And then about 6 months later, now into 2010, they issued us a subsequent letter because the legislature had eliminated the 10% cost overrun provision. We were fine with that. But in 2010, we were told how much the Betsy credit for a second time would be. And then we went out and tried to find a pass-through partner, which is essential for us as an attempt to monetize the credit. We recently found one. It took us about a year, but we did find one. And now we're being told by the Department of Energy that if the pass-through partner writes us a check this year for the entire pass-through amount, they may begin to take the credit next year. So, in effect, for a project that under the typical statutory guidelines would have gotten final certification in 2009, the pass-through partner is not able to take the credit until 2012. So, in effect, the five-year Betsy, which was extended to a six-year Betsy, is now an eight-year Betsy. And frankly, the counterparty is somewhat skeptical of its willingness to wait another year actually to take advantage of the credit. So I would submit to the committee a number of suggestions for changes to the legislation as introduced. I think there's a fairly limited number of cases in which this is occurring, but I really don't think stretching out the ability to use the credit for that long for a project that's now been up and running for 2 years, it was really the intent of the legislature when it adopted the amendments in 2009 and 2010. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm curious, Mr. Brown, you used the word projects are frozen, which makes me wonder what kinds of projects are we talking about and how many jobs are we talking about frozen?
Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Bailey, in the case of our two projects, they're both just under $30 million. One's in Christmas Valley and one's just outside of Lakeview. The construction jobs would be about 50. And we would start as soon as this bill is signed by the governor. The uncertainty caused by the regulations that I've described in here means that we just can't get our financing until it gets cleared up. And they would be Oregon's two largest solar projects by quite a distance. They're each about 6 megawatts on the D.C. capacity side.
Thank you, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to look at the change proposed on page 2 of the bill and just fit it into the situation that was described, the 8-year Betsy, so to speak. And I was just looking at paragraph D. And when it says the transferee holding the credit that's been transferred may not claim the tax credit, so on and so forth, for any tax year prior to the tax year in which the transferee, and then we would delete obtained the credit. What did that mean? I'm just curious what the obtained the credit meant. That's now going to go away, but how did you guys read that when you saw it initially? In the context of the 2007 through now 2011 story that was told on the 8-year Betsy.
Sure. Well, to the co-chairs and Representative Bentz, as my understanding of that provision was that it was an attempt, and a successful one, by the holders of a Betsy, a pass-through partner, to apply the years of the credit to prior tax years, years before the transferee received the credit, and that's fine. If in 2010, as the legislature did, it didn't want a Betsy, a pass-through partner, to amend its 2008 or 2009 tax return to claim the credit, fine. What's really relevant to our concern in this is the subsequent language in, I believe it's in Section 3, that attempts to be amended in this statute, which allows you know, which requires that the credit be triggered the year after the recipient receives it. Now, the Department of Energy has interpreted a final certification as being the point at which not only is the application processed, but the pass-through partner writes a check to the transferor, in other words, the developer of the project. So, in other words, our pass-through partner would have to write us a check in 2011 in order to begin to claim the credit in 2012. This legislation attempts to fix that, but it only applies, the effective date is only applicable to projects that come after a January 1, 2010 trigger date. And as I described, our project is prior to that trigger date.
Thank you.
That's Section 4.
Yes, sir.
Right. Yep, Mr. Brown.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bentz, if I can supplement Mr. Lynch's answer. we're trying to avoid a winners and losers situation on December 31st. So we had an understanding in February that if the pass-through partners paid their money and all the paperwork's been submitted to the department, that the credit will be effective as of the time that all that got submitted, and that if for some reason it's not processed on December 31st but falls into early January, we don't have a situation where the pass-through partner has to wait a whole nother year to get the credit. So Mr. O'Neill testified that on line 36 that word transferee should be transferor, which I think maybe was causing some of Representative Bentz's confusion. There was a typo there. But our idea is that once all the paperwork is in, then that crystallizes the moment for which the credit is earned.
I understand. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. So that was an error in the original bill, or the original law, then, isn't it? No?
No, it was actually an error by me. Sorry.
Then I guess I'm not sure what we're talking about, because the word that I see on line 36, page 2, is part of the original law. Now, maybe I misunderstand what you're reaching for.
I misunderstood your question. Yes, it was a mistake in February. Yes.
Right. Chris?
Well, I think it's a matter of, it's the transferee is the party who obtains the credit, and the transferor would be the person who files the application.
Right.
So by changing it from the obtained to, from the party who obtains it to the party who files the completed application, there's the necessary change to go from transferee to transferor.
Okay.
Is how I'm reading it.
So the original law was correct for given what it was trying to do, but we're trying to do something different now, and so that word has to change.
Right. Well, I don't know about doing something different, but clarifying what's trying to be done, but the perspective of change. I mean, in the original language, the transferee obtained the credit.
Right.
The situation is whoever owns the project files the paperwork for the application, and then they will transfer the credit.
Right.
So the original language was the transferee obtains it.
Right.
And the intent, as I think was stated, was to prevent people from filing amended prior year tax returns. So if the language is modified so that you're focusing on the filing of the application, the transferee doesn't file that application, it's the transferor
who
does.
Right. We're using the sentence to get at a different point in time, and therefore a different actor is involved.
Yes.
All right. So in effect, then, what we're saying is the proposed change in the bill needs to be fixed in order to get to that.
Yes.
We need an amendment. Okay. Representative Bentz?
No. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just gradually coming to an understanding.
Well, you can see that I am, too. Yeah.
Still making progress, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Right. Well, we'll try to parse it some more. Other questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen. We very much appreciate your coming to Salem today and letting us know about these important matters. Gabe Johnson, Mark, it looks like Thalacker. Gentlemen, please.
Thank you.
State your name for the record and give your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, other distinguished members of the committee. My name is Gabriel Johnson, and I represent McKinstry. McKinstry has been in construction business for 50 years and has served Oregon for over 40 years. We work with both private and public entities to design, build, operate, and maintain high-performance buildings. We currently employ 250 office staff and union craft labor in Oregon and added 75 full-time employees this year alone. As you know, Oregon's K-12 schools have been severely impacted by the recent economic downturn. Excuse me. While these schools struggle to retain teachers and offer core programs, they are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars each year to operate inefficient and outdated equipment and infrastructure. During these tough economic times, schools have and continue to look to the Betsy Conservation Program to help fund projects that produce utility bill savings that can be reinvested back into the classroom. Betsy has allowed McKinstry to partner with Oregon's K-12 schools across the state to develop energy conservation projects that save schools money on utility bills while creating high-wage local construction jobs. In most instances, McKinstry school clients would be unable to finance such projects without the Betsy assistance. Unfortunately, the readjustment of Betsy pre-certification amounts has retroactively altered financing for several McKinstry projects throughout the state. As a result, these projects and the jobs and utility savings they create are currently in jeopardy. I would like to tell you about one example project that demonstrates the importance of Betsy as an integral funding source that keeps the project alive. At Estacada School District, we're currently engaging with them to install a biomass boiler at their high school. The biomass boiler is intended to replace an oil-burning boiler. And as we approach the project, the school board, understanding the cuts across the board with teachers and programs, made it very clear that the project needed to be funded in a budget-neutral state, which meant that there was no requirement for general fund dollars to be contributed to the project. In essence, their priority was on teachers and programs rather than the construction. And in order for the construction of the project to move forward, it needed to be funded using these three different mechanisms. One was the energy savings created by the project. The second was a state energy program grant that the district received. And the third was the funding of the Betsy. It's approximately $1 million project, whereas Betsy contributed $65,000 towards that project. So without those three integral funding pieces, that the project is in jeopardy because the board has advised both McKinstry and the administrators of the school district that they can't support the project without that funding coming through. So the potential lost energy savings, in addition to the project going away, would be approximately $112,000 during the first 20 years of the project. The life expectancy of the boiler goes beyond 30 years. So there's an additional 10 years of energy savings that would be accumulated on top of that. The boiler is manufactured by a local manufacturer in the state of Oregon, St. Helens, and the fuel supply company also comes from Oregon. So in addition to the construction jobs that take place for the construction of the project, there's also suppliers of the equipment and the fuel that are in jeopardy. Additionally, the greenhouse gas reduction of the project, which is approximately 500,000 pounds of CO2 reduction, equating to planting 80 acres of trees or removing 33 cars from the road, would also no longer occur. To ensure these projects and many more like them move forward, I urge a yes vote on House Bill 3606. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Bailey, and committee members. My name is Mark Thalacker. I manage Three Sisters Irrigation District in Sisters in Central Oregon. I'm here today to testify in behalf of support for 3606. We in Central Oregon have been building quite a number of water conservation projects that also involve energy. In the case of my district, it was a conservation project that conserves about 3 million kilowatts a year. In the case of Central Oregon Irrigation District, Juniper Ridge project, which will eventually be a 5.5 megawatt project, and then Swale Irrigation District, which is a 0.75 megawatt project. And all three of these projects are completed, operational, And a number of us, Swally and myself, we filed our final certification for the Betsy last June of 10, and COID filed in October, I think, of 10. Because of the interpretation of the revenue statute, basically we were have been just left in limbo until recently. And so it kind of pushes to the point that these are projects that were very complicated, involve restoring stream flows for endangered fish, addressing Clean Water Act issues, but also had the benefit of either conserving energy or creating new renewable energy. And in order to basically pay off loans, we need to capture the Betsy and the commitment that was made to us by the Department of Energy. I will say the department has worked very hard to try and solve this problem, and I think we are to that point, but I think that the legislation is important to move forward so that others have certainty as well. I appreciate Representative Bailey and Senator Telfer's work and Representative Brewer's, because this is very technical and complicated, but it is something that is very necessary.
Thank you. Questions? One for you. How did the department finally get this resolved for you, and is it working?
Well, we'll wait. We're waiting on our CAM letters, and we're supposed to receive those today. So if that occurs, then that'll be great. But I know there are a number of other people who, you know, are waiting, and this will help solve their problem. Obviously, irrigation districts are local governments, and so we don't pay taxes, and so to apply statutes that we would be paying taxes was in error, and I think that the department is secure in how they are going to interpret statute at this point.
Thank you. Other questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen, very much for testifying. We appreciate your coming across the mountain today.
Thank you.
Thanks. Is there anyone else who wants to testify this morning on House Bill 3606? Yes, sir. Please come forward.
My name is Patrick Schellerup. I'm the regional manager for Light Solar Corp. I'm not going to take a ton of your time today. I think David Brown did a good job at explaining why these technical fixes are necessary for the Betsy program as a whole. I'd like to echo some of his statements and some of the other ones that just bringing certainty to the program will help us move forward and continue being able to do business here in the state. It does make it very difficult trying to hit a target that seems like it's moving a lot. And I think that a lot of the fixes that are outlined in 3606 will help clarify a lot of those issues for us.
Thank you. Further questions for Mr. Schiller? Thank you, sir. We appreciate your testimony. And just a quick comment that I think most of the people who've testified here this morning already know. When we passed the original increase in the Betsy in 2007, we didn't realize at that time how popular the program was going to be. And we've been playing catch-up ever since. You have experienced the results of our attempting to play catch-up directly in the changes in the expectations that you've experienced from the department. And I think the department has been trying hard to respond to what we've been telling them, what the legislature has been telling them to do. I would love to be able to say that we're finished with all of that. I don't think we are. I suspect that that we're going to continue to be working on catch-up, and of course the work that is happening on going forward may make some major changes in the going forward portion of the Betsy. I'm hoping that we are very nearly finished with the things that affect projects that were already in the works before the sunset dates.
I can't promise that that's the case, but I hope it is. Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Is there anything else this morning then on House Bill 3606? With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3606 and open a public hearing on the other bill, House Bill 2546. And did we ever get the amendment on that? If we have it? Okay.
Co-Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, we've gotten the Dash 1 amendment on House Bill 2546. House Bill 2546 would allow...
Has that been distributed? It's coming. Okay, good.
House Bill 2546 would allow a late filing for an exemption related to municipal corporations, churches, or other organizations, fraternal organizations, and charitable organizations that receive a tax property tax exemption due to their status. It would currently the late filing can be done as late as April of the year following the tax year for which the exemption is claimed, and this measure would extend the ability to file late for a exemption for up to 5 years after the tax year for which the exemption is claimed. And the Dash 1 amendment would require that a first-time filer either be a public entity or demonstrate good and sufficient cause for failing to file a timely claim if they file it under this 5-year timeline.
So basically substitutes for the first two lines on, or the first two changes on the lines on page 3 for the new language.
Correct.
Okay. Do we have witnesses signed up for this bill? We do not. Counties want to be heard?
Most enthusiastic.
Yeah, an enthusiastic response. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Gail Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties, we understand the purpose of this the underlying purpose of this bill is to deal with a specific situation and kind of put a bow on it, and it's done well by the Dash 1 amendments, so we don't have any problem with the Dash 1 amendments. The original bill is very broad, though, and it created some reaction among those who would have to administer it, but the Dash 1 amendments appear fine.
Well, does the Dash 1 correct the problem, or simply reduce the number of people who might qualify?
Well, I believe it Mr. Chair, I believe it reduces it to the category of people that was intended to address.
Right.
Yes.
First time filers.
Yes.
Okay. And your interpreter, first time filer is what? Who is a first time filer and who isn't?
Mr. Chair, I would assume it would be somebody who had not filed previously for the same exemption.
Exemption.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. Let me describe, committee, briefly how this originally came up. Remember that we allowed in a previous statute, I think 2 years ago, for some... changes of this kind to be done by churches that were late in filing, and basically allowed them to either pay the tax or file late after a notice was received, and pay a penalty in order to sort of reinstate back to that date. And what happened is that a religious organization in Cresswell had leased a part of their church facilities for a daycare program that was operated as a nonprofit, also a nonprofit corporation. And either the church or the daycare organization, I forget which, received a notice after a number of years that they
had failed to file and therefore owed property taxes. I don't think this bill actually applies to that case because it goes forward rather than backward, but it would deal with situations similar to that in a similar way to the situation that we already dealt with that involved churches themselves. That originally came up because of the change in status of the parishes of the Archdiocese of Portland when they quit operating under the Archdiocese Corporation and established their own, and apparently a number of them were late filing their applications. So anyway, that's the point of the bill, and I would ask the committee to study it carefully and see if there's additional amendments that might be needed before we look at it again. Anything else? Okay. With that, we'll close the public hearing. We have nothing else this morning. Nothing. All right. Committee's adjourned. Thank you.